Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hi, I'm Tricia Keffer from sunny Key Largo, Florida, your host for New Books in Architecture with a special mini-series in Landscape Architecture, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. If you have any ideas for books, please drop me an email at plantspeoplelove@gmail.com. And today's special guest hail from Europe. We have Teaching Landscape, the Studio Experience. And I'm going to try to pronounce the names correctly. Forgive me, audience. We have the four authors are Karsten Joens.
Jørgensen.
Yeah. Jørgensen. There you go. Nigel Cardison. And she's not here. She is here. The other one is Elke Mertens and Richard Stiles. Richard, that was easy.
That was good.
I did my best. I'm going to let them all say their names correctly now, and we'll start with Richard. Why don't you introduce yourself to the audience and tell them a little bit about yourself?
Hi, I'm Richard Stiles. I'm now the Emeritus Professor of Landscape Architecture at the Vienna University of Technology, where I was teaching for nearly a quarter of a century, I think, when I go back, teaching landscape architecture, but in this case, to architects and planners. So it was a slightly different experience, I think, to that of my colleagues. And I've also been active at the European level in terms of the European Council of Landscape Architecture Schools, as have my other colleagues. And we've been working together to network and develop initiatives at the European level. So I think that's enough for an intro.
Okay.
Thank you.
Elke?
Hi. My name is Elke Mertens. I am traditional landscape architect, educated in Berlin at the Technical University. Have worked a little bit, and I have been a professor for garden architecture and open space management for a bit over 20 years now at the University of Applied Sciences in Neubrandenburg, which is in the northeast of Germany. And I met the colleagues in a long working period together in the European issues of teaching and research a little bit. Richard was the founder of a big EU project, which gave us a lot of money to meet, communicate, and really bring our discipline forward. And that was very, very, a good time and still goes on. And this was the crown of our collaboration, probably, to bring out the books.
To do the book. And then, Karsten?
Yes, thank you. My name is Karsten Jørgensen. I'm also Professor Emeritus at the Norwegian University of Life Sciences. And at Oslo School of Architecture, I've been teaching and doing research in landscape architecture for almost 40 years in Norway, in these two schools. And then I also became involved in the European issues with Richard and Elke and others, and completed this book project, among some others.
Richard, could you just tell us briefly about the fourth author who's otherwise booked today, Nigel?
Sorry, I lost the connection just now, but I can briefly mention Nilgül Karadeniz. She is a professor in Turkey at the University of Ankara, and she is, I think, more of a landscape planner than a landscape designer. And she's also been closely involved with, obviously with the book, but with cooperation, international cooperation at the wider European level.
Well, this is good. Well, Richard, let's start with you then. What was your motivation for writing this book and putting it together?
I think it's important to stress that we, as a team of four people, were acting as editors. We weren't the authors. Each chapter has its own author. What the interesting thing was, though, was, I think, as part of our contacts at the European level, with colleagues in a whole range of countries, there was a lot of interest in teaching and in talking about teaching, and there weren't any books really at the time looking at teaching landscape architecture, and the book resulted from an initial call for papers or for chapters on teaching, and the result was much greater than we expected. It was almost overwhelming. I think you could say there were, I think, at least there were over 70 chapters were submitted, and obviously we started to look at them and try and work out which ones we thought wouldn't go in the book, and it was very difficult to find those because they were all interesting, they were all good, and we gradually came to the idea thinking, well, wouldn't it be possible to do two books? To cut a long story short, that's what ended up as happening. We proposed splitting the chapters that had been submitted into two separate books. And the one we're talking about today is actually the second of the two. The first was the Routledge Handbook of Teaching Landscape, which dealt with, to some extent, more theoretical issues and conventional forms of teaching, and we collected all of the chapters relating above all to studio teaching, which is what this second book is about, together, and they became then the second book. So it's difficult to say that was the motivation for creating this book, because originally the motivation was for just creating a book about teaching rather than this specific one about studio teaching, but that's it evolved from this process, I think.
Karsten?
Yes?
Why did you get involved in this as an editor? What was your motivation? What did you enjoy about putting together this book?
Yes, I was. I've also been a founding editor of a journal called JOLA, Journal of Landscape Architecture, which was established by ECLAS, by this European collaboration body. And while I was editor there for 10 years from 2006, I discovered that there were a lot of people who wanted to share their experiences in teaching. So, and they had a lot of creative ideas, but the profile of the journal is a little bit more more scientific. It's more scholarly, analytical. So most of the papers did not fit. So I thought that maybe a book could sort of solve this problem. A lot of good and creative teachers who wanted to share their interesting ideas, and then we got together on the initiative of ECLAS and formulated a call for papers that Richard mentioned.
And then we go to Elke. If I'm saying it right, you know, I'm going to admit my family's Scots-Irish, and if I pronounce it wrong, I'm just going to come up with a nickname for you. So that's meant in fun. So Elke, why did you want to do this book?
Actually, I think I ran into this question of how do we teach, which didactics can we use, pedagogic and all these things, which was very, very in about 10 years, 15 years ago. And I thought this is really interesting to reflect on the teaching. What am I doing? What is my goal with this? And I out of this ECLAS and collaboration project that we had anyway, we talked so much about the teaching process, but also about the Bologna process, the knowledge and understanding what should be the skills of the students in the end of meeting us somehow. And do I have to teach? Can I teach everything? Or is there also a way of advising the students to find the right way themselves? And this was really interesting, the discussion, the exchange with the colleagues. So I wanted to make that book for a long time. And then I was so happy that Carsten took the initiative and let me be with the group. Because he knew so much about making books, and Jola was so successful with him that it was, it turned out really well.
Now, the book is divided into, of course, I love history, I'll be honest, and you start with the Beaux-Arts to Bauhaus, but then you've got four sections. You've got design studios, landscape construction classes, landscape planning studios, landscape history and theory. So how does this all play together? I guess what I'm trying to ask is, why did you divide the book like this, and what can the reader or the listeners today get from each chapter or each section? I'll let anybody take that one.
May I say something? Start? Sorry. Well, sorry, Richard.
Please. Yeah.
Well, I think we are a bit in the tradition of landscape architecture thinking, and you have to sort the articles that you have. If there are too many, you have to somehow, we discuss them, we put them on this pile or on that pile, and we came up with actually three pillars: the nature, the construction, creativity, and then maybe the history as the fourth. So this is very simple, I think, how we divided the chapters. But then when you look at the chapters a bit deeper, you will see they reflect more on maybe landscape planning, but they also use methods that we could find in landscape design or other ways. So that's, I think, more the way of sorting out and making this book a bit clearer for the reader, of course.
Richard, you want to jump in?
Yeah, I mean, obviously, it was a bit of post-rationalization, if you like. We made an open call for chapters. We got a certain range of things that were submitted, and then we tried to create some kind of structure out of what was there. So we didn't start off with the structure and then say, well, we want to commission people to write chapters on landscape planning studios or on construction. It worked very much bottom up, and we then, as editors, tried to derive the structure from what was submitted.
Yeah, I like at the beginning your introduction. You have Beaux-Arts to Bauhaus and beyond, and the four of you put this together. So, how does your book go beyond the Beaux-Arts to Bauhaus? How does this move landscape architecture forward? I'll let Carsten jump in.
Okay, I think there are many answers to that question because the book is so diverse. There are so many approaches are presented here, but one answer is that it moves landscape architecture forwards by being so diverse, by presenting a lot of approaches to teaching landscape that comes from very different schools of thinking and teaching. And I mean, one example could be could be the chapter by Carola Wingren about dancing the landscape. She takes her students into landscapes, urban or rural landscapes, and they are performing sort of dance projects to understand the landscape they are going to work in. And this sounds maybe strange from the outside, but it's actually part of a longer tradition. The famous landscape architect Lawrence Halprin and his wife Anna Halprin have been doing these things for a long, long time, and Anna even presented an example of this in the Venice Biennale in, some years ago. So this is and there have been a lot of others doing similar things. So I was very happy that we got Carola Wingren's chapter showing this very specific approach to understanding the landscape, which is probably one of the keys to many of the chapters that they are about how to understand the landscape and the task, which is really the two things that have to go together in a landscape project.
From Beaux-Arts to Bauhaus, how does this book go beyond those two schools of thought?
Yeah. Okay. Thank you. I think this bridge is the Bauhaus had its 100th birthday in 2019, as we all know. And okay, it was in Germany, so it was close to where I am living. But it has had a wide influence on architects worldwide, and we still feel that students who study architecture somewhere in the world, when it comes to Germany, they study Bauhaus. And Bauhaus was just such a small, short period, really, but the influence is very, very wide. And so at the same time, we had the first European program for landscape architecture in Karsten's school. So that was, but Bauhaus didn't care about landscape architecture or whatever that was called at that time. They neglected this open space totally. But now I think we go far beyond. We have 100 years of Bauhaus, 100 years of academic education in landscape architecture in Europe, and that made us very proud, but still we are still a young profession, academic profession. This is one thing, and the other thing is that I would say that we, like Bauhaus, was very rational in designing, in using the materials. But what we do and what we teach and have to teach is not only to make a site function well. When we would talk about safety, for example, we wouldn't plant a tree, we wouldn't put a bench somewhere, we would put a lot of light to make it really safe. But what we would miss is creating atmosphere. And I think we create better sites for people. And that is really a bit of Bauhaus, but it goes beyond for our well-being and the surrounding and whatever. So I think especially now we need a lot more in when we see climate change is happening and so on. We have a lot of challenges that we have to address, and that's far beyond Bauhaus, I would say.
Richard, would you like to try that one too?
I agree absolutely with what Elke is saying. I mean, the Bauhaus didn't really consider what went on outside the buildings, and that's really what our focus is as landscape architects. But I think what's important about the Bauhaus and how it differs from the Beaux-Arts tradition was that Beaux-Arts, you knew what you were going to produce, and you, students were basically drilled into reproducing examples of the perfect solution. Whereas what the Bauhaus did was to turn all that on its end, as it were, and to start a much more open process of teaching. And I think that's what certainly studio teaching is very much about now in landscape architecture. We don't know what the answer is going to be at the end of the studio. What we're trying to teach is much more about a process rather than creating a certain predetermined project, product. I think that's the first step. The beyond step, obviously, is moving into perhaps the digital world, where again, new methods and new approaches and new ways of perceiving the environment are becoming central. But also, I think another aspect of teaching is also the question of involving the community and the wider public. So it's not just the expert, as it were, who's at the center of the creative process, but very much this idea of the community as part of the team, as it were. And I think that's also part of this moving beyond the Bauhaus. I think the Bauhaus was very much about the experts, and we're probably still experts, but experts in being open involving others and drawing them into the process of planning and design and creativity.
Well, let me start into, I'd like to talk about each of these sections a little bit too. And the first one is design studios. And I will say, actually, one of your chapters in here, Roxy Thorne, I interviewed her, I think it was last year. It was about materiality, et cetera. She had a very interesting book as well. So out of these, can you all talk about one of these chapters and why you decided to include it in a book, and how it this common phrase I've heard a lot is, you know, how it moves landscape architecture forward. Can you choose one of these chapters, each of you, and then discuss why you put it in the book? We'll start with Elke.
Maybe I would choose the last chapter in that section by Susan Harrington. When I first started reading that, I was thinking, well, she only applies this four concept, the four trace concept of Christophe Giroux, what we knew and was very theoretical, very good concept. But, you know, we didn't want a chapter that repeats other people's methods. And then I read further, of course, because I know Susan Harrington. She's a well-known professor in the University of British Columbia in Vancouver. So she wouldn't really do an easy thing. And she applied this method to an old railway section on a not used site anymore, and brought her students out to explore that site. And it was, you know, the railway lines are often in not the nicest areas of a town. And then when they are not in use anymore, then the sites don't get better. So the students went out to check the site and to see what is there. They found the butterflies and wildlife and whatever. So they really came up with a lot of good analysis, and then on top of that did good designs for that site. So I think it was really the starting point was a well-known method, but then they exploded. And this is what a studio is very often about. You just give a starting point, and then the students go out, and you can just advise them and put them into this or that direction, but you cannot say, I want this result at the end. So I think this is a really fine example of a good studio work.
Richard, is there a favorite chapter that you like?
Well, maybe the chapter by Bettina Lamm and Anna Margarete Wagner on urban interventions is something that is worth pulling out. Just coming back to this question of beyond the Bauhaus, the book is about studio, and studio is obviously a place, at least in first and foremost, is the place where students work. But of course, studio is now a method, an approach. And I think what's critical about this chapter is that it's about getting outside the studio. It's about going out into the world and looking at it one-to-one and developing interventions and concepts. In the case of this studio, it's about actually building these interventions, interventions which maybe also are a little bit different in terms of what were perhaps earlier approaches to teaching. Rather than planning a whole area, this intervention approach is actually focusing on particular critical places and taking an approach which is a bit like acupuncture, if you like, finding the critical areas and focusing on them as a basic starting point for transforming a wider area. And this design studio that Bettina Lamm and Anna Margarete Wagner are talking about is doing exactly that, focusing on particular areas and actually building one-to-one interventions, structures into this landscape as a way of transforming it and a way of also getting the public to perceive these places differently. And I think that's very important too. It's about an interaction with people. It's not just about being in the studio, in the academic ivory tower. It's about creating actual physical landscapes, which of course is something that is not always easy to do in teaching in a higher education context. So I think that this chapter is very interesting from that point of view. And obviously to be recommended.
And so pick a chapter that you like from Design Studios and tell me, why did you include it in the book?
Yeah, thank you. It's difficult to choose because they are all very interesting. I already mentioned the dancing chapter, but I would also point at the first chapter by Marco Casagrande, who is a Finnish landscape architect and artist who has a very big and influential international practice in landscape architecture and art projects. But he's especially famous for his projects in Taiwan, where he has been implementing something he calls landscape acupuncture, where he makes small interventions that have big influences or big results in a way. And what is also fascinating about what he's doing, he's both a practitioner and a professor, so he's also teaching, is that he's going what you could call outside the box. He's always looking for alternative solutions, and he's doing breaking the law here when he engaged the students in trying to to save a neighborhood that was supposed to be removed, he engages the people there and this way of working with the whole landscape, including the people and coming up with interesting, strange ideas, is, I think, very inspiring.
Now, on the next section, I've noticed that you've only got two chapters on landscape construction. We have to build our crazy ideas. How did we only end up with two chapters here?
May I say something about that?
Yes.
Just as a starting point, maybe. Yes, it is a part of our discipline that we usually tend to not think as being able for design or any studio work. And yeah, Carsten, we have a lot more chapters or deeper going chapters in the handbook, because construction, you need to learn a lot, and you need to know how to do things and which concrete to use and all these things. But what we pointed out here, wanted to point out, is that first of all, the construction belongs to the whole process. If we just develop ideas, funny ideas, whatever ideas, we do need to come up with a possible site plan in the end, if we want to change the world or this site that we are working on. So we also need to be able to construct that site in the way to have it long livable and whatever. But very often the construction lectures are seen as separate. And here we have this Peter Pitschek's chapter. He is a professor in Rapperswil in Switzerland. And he's talking about rainwater and also about the building information modeling and about bringing in the construction technical aspects into the design. And I think this was really well done. Very good chapter. He's not only the construction site who is calculating the rainwater that has to be brought somewhere away from the houses. And he has a, at the same time, very modern and at least for Germany, I can say that. And I can see, I think that it also applies to the United States, for example, the attitude that we come away from talking about the problem with water and rainwater. We have to put it away, put it to the sewer, and don't see it anymore. We have to be very respectful with the rainwater, because we have more and more periods where we need the water for irrigation and not in the sewer system, where it is not the right place for it. So Pitschek can address all these aspects in just one chapter, which is still technical, but in a design attitude and bringing these things together. So he's also, he goes out with the students. You see the picture with a big excavator or the drones. And so uses the computer work very, very much, but it is always integrated into a good design. And I think this is just something that is landscape architecture. We bring the ideas to real life, and that's why we need the construction classes also. And that we didn't want to omit the section, but didn't have too many chapters.
Chapters?
Yeah, sorry.
It's okay. That's true. That makes sense, because it gets really into like technical books too. The next one you have is Landscape Planning Studios. And you do have, since we don't have, I think we're missing the French influence here. Can anybody talk about the chapter from, where is it? Oh, Teaching Landscape Urbanism in the French Context. How and why did you include that chapter? I'll let somebody jump in. Richard.
I'm just thumbing through the book to remind myself of this chapter. We obviously had an open call for chapters from everywhere. So obviously we had inputs from France, and this idea of landscape urbanism is something which is not essentially French from that point of view, but it's I think an approach that's quite theoretical, and it's a question of again, maybe in comparison to the situation with construction, how do you teach this in a studio? How do you look at the concept of urbanism from a landscape point of view and apply that at a large scale? And I think this chapter looks at both the theoretical background and the ways that it can be applied in planning studios. And I think it focuses on this issue of strategic approaches to urban open space and landscape, which is something which I think needs to be increasingly focused on as urban areas are becoming the sort of the natural habitat of Homo sapiens now. And this chapter, I think, focuses on the various approaches for regarding the landscape as part of an integral part of an urbanism approach, whether it's a particularly French approach or whether it's just an example from France, I will leave open. But I think it's a very good approach that shows this strategic view of urban landscape and how we can deal with that, with examples from Bordeaux and other cities, Strasbourg, which have come out of design studios, which are, I think it's again another characteristic of the studio. It's both looking at a generic issue of the urban landscape and then a specific topic and a specific place. How do you apply this generic issue to a particular context? And again, it's another characteristic of studio teaching, I think. Both a broader issue and a very concrete place and a question relating to that.
Karsten, is there a chapter in the planning studios section that you would like to discuss?
Yeah, I think they are also very fascinating. We might maybe mention the first chapter by Karl Steinitz, who is presenting a specific sort of studio that he has been running all over the world for many years, engaging students with different backgrounds and building teams to solve specific and very often very realistic and concrete problems in an urban context, usually. And he's following a specific pattern that he has been developing theoretically and arriving at a lot of very interesting results, not least process-wise. I mean, the way that he develops processes that can point at and develop solutions for very very specific urban planning projects.
And the final section, let's talk about it: landscape history and theory. Elke, would you like to discuss one of these chapters here?
You mentioned the French context, so maybe I can figure that you like the French art of landscaping. So I would start with Bernadette Blanchon. She's teaching in Versailles, a very, very nice school, and also a very nice colleague there, professor. And this school is one of the highest ranking schools in France, at least, and very high also in Europe, I think. And I think their approach is really interesting. They go back in the history and they go out and draw and sketch and use really a sketchbook, which is always very wanted, but not so often done, I think. But I think the French school is really well known for a lot of good drawings, as the Americans are, I think, as well. But I cannot really ask my students too much about that. And then they work a lot with sections. I think that's also something that we do. We know how to do it, and we very often do. But here, their sections show a lot of the development and different stages of the where was what built when and so on. I think this is very nice, and it gives you a good impression on the images that French, or I mean, no, the whole book has a lot of images, but I especially like this, and that they point out this type of multi-scale approach and working a lot with sketching and sections. So go ahead and find out how she's doing and this and how she developed this. I think it's really worthwhile, as all the other chapters are, of course.
Well, I guess I'll confess. I mean, Claude Monet is my favorite landscape architect, I will say. You know, I mean, it's favorite of, well, a lot of people. Well, you know, when I landed in Europe, when I was actually in my 30s, and I was just amazed by all the parks over there and the emphasis on that versus the United States. You know, we have a lot of big national parks. We do it, but I really liked how Europe integrated parks into the cityscape too. That was really nice. And the urban planning. Maybe you guys can talk a little bit about that too. Do you think it's, this is a little bit outside of the book, but it's kind of relevant. You know, how does, you know, if you've been to the U.S., how does it compare to Europe when we kind of talk about landscape architecture in that way?
That's very interesting.
Well, maybe I'll say something because I don't know the U.S. very well, so it's easy to make generalizations. you have little experience about. But I mean, I think the car is obviously a big issue in American cities, and obviously, it's become a big issue in European cities too. But European cities, I think, got their basic structure before the car became so dominant. So this idea of pedestrian scale and the need to create places where people can walk and enjoy the landscape has been, purely for historical reasons, I think, much more important for a longer period of time than it has in the States. This idea of creating urban structure, green space as a sort of backbone, as a skeleton for the urban environment, also certainly goes back to the reaction against the industrial cities in the 19th century, the need to create green lungs and breathing spaces. And this integration of parks, I think, is something which has a long tradition. I think we've neglected it for quite a long time, but the idea of green infrastructure is now allowing us to rediscover it, hopefully in new ways, and to reinforce it. So I think that's perhaps a difference which we can build on. But obviously, there are big potentials in the States as well, I'm sure.
Karsten, did you want to say something?
Yes, if I can. I agree with what Richard says, but he's even a little bit too modest, because the development in Europe started end of the 18th century. Actually, they were building parks for people already second half of the 18th century. And what is one example is the so-called Englischer Garten in Munich, which was opened in 1889, I think, and 1789. What is interesting is that the man who became sort of the father of landscape architecture in the United States, Frederick Law Olmsted, he came to visit Europe around 1850, in the 50s, and he discovered a park in Liverpool or near Liverpool that he was fell very much in love with, and he he wrote a book about this later on, Walks and Talks of an American Farmer in Europe, and he describes this experience as sort of groundbreaking, and he decided to work for this type of development in the United States, and then he became the designer of Central Park and a lot of other very important parks in the U.S. And then he became so famous that the European landscape architects started to visit the parks of Frederick Law Olmsted to bring inspiration back to Europe. So there's been a sort of a transatlantic conversation here. Now, Elke and Richard, I have lost my sound. What about you, Tricia? Can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you. Yes.
Yeah, good. So there's a long tradition of urban parks in Europe, which is, I think, part of the reason that you see this difference that, as Richard say, they are integrated very much into the green structure of the cities in Europe.
So, it is. It's just, I mean, when I grew up, of course, I'm already, at the age of, cars are the only transportation we look forward to getting our driver's license. And then being in Europe, and being able to walk everywhere, it was, it was great for two reasons. Number one, I loved how they had cafes, cafes were integrated into parks and the whole urban landscape, and it was so walkable. And I mean, I could eat chocolate mousse at lunch and not worry about it because I walk for a couple hours a day, at least. It was great.
Hmm.
And versus the United States, it's like no chocolate mousse for you.
If you have a car, you can get it. may I add a little bit to that?
Sure.
Because I think comparisons are sometimes a bit difficult because I think each country, each city, each site has its own history and development, and also the people are adapted to what they have, what they are used to. But I did experience what Richard said, because I was an exchange student when I was 16. I came to Memphis, Tennessee, where there was no one walking around. So I did some sports when I was younger. So I was so happy to live close to a park, and I went there very often, but sometimes I also went to the store. And on that way, people would stop in, driving by in their car, stop and ask me if they could take me somewhere. And I was just going, no, please let me walk. This is all I want to do. I don't want to get anywhere. I want to walk. But on the other hand, I think when you see New York City with the Central Park, this is such a big example of a good integrated park in a new modern city that where we look to. If you sometimes it's like what you know where you grew up, and then you go somewhere else, you see, wow, this is exciting. So value what you have, and I think we can learn from one another, but it's not better or worse. It's just different, I would say. And I really experienced, I went on a research trip. I went back because I collected friends and colleagues and so on. So for such a long time, and I went back and on a research trip about how cities react to climate change with landscape architecture projects. And I found a lot of projects in the United States, but also in other countries where in North and South America, where I was, where I think, well, great, it's always good to know more of the world and not only the standard German norms and laws. And we have so many numbers, and maybe this is German, but and it kills creativity, and it kills the effort or the excitement of landscape architects to really act positively and progressively in their projects. And I would say the self-confident of landscape architects was really good in the States. Well, at least the ones I had contact to. So here I would say our self-confidence is not really perfect now.
Well, that's true. And it's a very good point that, contrast and compare, but it's not a judgment either. And for all the car people out there, yes, I love my car too. My first car was my dad's old, I don't know if y'all are familiar with it or not, my dad's old 69 Camaro. It was like the best little hot rod. Zoom, zoom. So I'm not, I like my car. But that's true. It's a good point. I think in the U.S. too, we'll say about the Everglades and our big national parks are just really phenomenal. We've really done a great job with that experience of wildness. And trying to preserve that. And I think that here too, that, more and more people are getting more interested in walkable areas. And, especially in Florida, a lot of the resorts are trying to plan more green spaces into them and making it walkable because while we love our cars, it's, I get a little tired of using it all the time too. I like to walk. I think we're falling in love with walking again.
If you have the choice, it would be the best.
But I think you can also say that we certainly haven't solved the problem of the car in Europe either. We've had projects with students as well designing parks on the space of a one car parking space. So 5 meters by 2.5 meters. This was one-to-one build projects, but there's a sort of need here to fight back and reclaim parking spaces one by one just about. And that's one of the big problems with upgrading urban landscapes, even in quite walkable, dense urban cities. Actually, people still want to be able to park their car where they can see it. There's still a big battle to be fought there, I think.
Well, it sounds like landscape architecture's got a lot of work cut out for it.
Sure.
Well, I want to thank you all for being here today. And I'd like to close with asking each of you, what projects are you working on now? And we'll start with Karsten.
Okay, I'm working, as you mentioned, you were interested in history. That's also my main interest, and it has been my main teaching and research. I'm working on historical archives, and that's also why I'm very happy we have this chapter in the last section by Lili Litschka and Roland Wick and Ulrike Krippner about how the voices from the archives can enrich our understanding of the landscape and of the environment in general. So I'm just now writing a review of a recent book was published a couple of weeks ago, about the famous Norwegian architect Sverre Fehn, who was designing also with nature in a way. So that's my current task.
Oh, that sounds interesting. You have to let me know. Elke, what are you working on now?
Well, I'm still teaching a lot of hours, and I try to really have a good contact with the students, and this it's also a lot of work. But as I just said, I'm still working on this climate change issue because I did my diploma and my doctorate in bioclimatic issues, bioclimatic and in urban planning and structures. So then when I finished that, there was no interest in climate change issues, and I couldn't find any job with that. So I was very happy to enter the school and go back to landscape architecture teaching. And now, for the last 10 years, more or less, this climate issue came back, and I decided, well, if I have knowledge in that field and the landscape architecture field, I do want to promote the landscape architecture in climate change adaptation of cities and with good projects, and promote landscape architecture, because I think green infrastructure can do a lot to lower the bad influences of climate change, and cities are really very vulnerable. So we have to tell the cities that there is something like landscape architecture and not only gray infrastructure. And on the other hand, I also want to show my discipline a little bit of more being self-confident in what we can do. But then we have to build in a resilient way, in a robust way. Sometimes it needs to be not only nice, but it needs to be sustainable. And what does that mean? It's the structures that we build and also the vegetation that we choose. So I think there are some easy, solutions are not easy, but some take them really easy, and then we don't solve the problem. That's my biggest topic right now.
So. And Richard, what you said you just retired, but do you have any projects for retirement?
Yeah, I'm still struggling to finish another book chapter on international cooperation. In landscape architecture education. It's one of those things I thought would be easy, and I suddenly discovered it's actually quite complicated, and you need to be able to look at it in different ways to which I originally thought. We've been talking to Elke about possibility. We were thinking about a paper on green infrastructure, which may be something that could develop further in the direction of a book, perhaps, but it's still very much early days.
And we include Ilgül also probably in that, because she's also very experienced. And Carsten, if he has time, because he's so busy, but would be good to follow up with this collaboration.
So we look forward to seeing some more projects from the four of you then in the future.
We hope so. Yeah.
Well, again, I want to thank the three of you for being here today and making this possible, transatlantic. It's been a challenge, but we made it through, and I thank you for being here. And I'd like to let the audience know that the book is Teaching Landscape, The Studio Experience, published by Routledge in 2020. And your editors are, I'm just going to say the first names, Karsten, Nigel, Elke, Richard, and it will be spelled correctly on the NBN website. And this is, of course, Tricia Keffer from sunny Key Largo, Florida, your host for New Books in Architecture with a special mini-series in Landscape Architecture, a podcast channel on the New Books Network.